Never mind the noise and the chatter. We are here for intelligent, fact-based conversation on this episode of Bergen Banter. Hi, everyone. I am Dr. Larry Levanka, and I am your host of the official Bergen Community College podcast. Have you heard the one about the dinosaurs coming back? No, really, the dinosaurs coming back. Well, maybe not the dinosaurs, or at least not quite yet, but the topic of de-extinction is coming en vogue. Now, you hear de-extinction? What does that mean? It actually means trying to bring back species that have been long extinct. Yeah, like the dodo and the woolly mammoth and maybe even dinosaurs someday. But there are companies out there that are pursuing this work in trying to re-engineer and bring back departed species. So today, we have Professor John Smalley of our Math, Science, Technology Department to talk about de-extinction and its place in our world and whether or not we're going to be running from a T-Rex anytime soon. Welcome to the program, Professor Smalley.
Thank you.
All right. So, de-extinction, the dodo, the woolly mammoth, the Tasmanian tiger. There are companies out there like Colossal being a big one that is working on this. What's this all about, de-extinction?
So basically, the idea is to use genetic information to try and de-extinct or bring back species that are no longer on the planet. There's a wide variety of technologies in play and that are used. And the thought is to, you know, bring these organisms back onto the planet. And we can get into issues as to, like, why would one want to do that other than the, hey, can we do it kind of a thing. And part of this gets into, for those of you who are familiar with the, in particular, the first Jurassic Park movie.
Right.
I'm reminded of Ian Malcolm, the chaos theorist, played by Jeff Goldblum, where he gets into a conversation and is like, you know, basically you were so worried about whether you could actually do this and you weren't worried about should you actually do this.
That
is a crux of this, you know, issue right now.
And life finds a way.
Life finds a way, exactly right.
And that is the title of this episode of the podcast. So okay, Colossal, other companies are actually doing this work. Tell us about the science of it. Functionally, what are they doing? Are they really bringing back these species or are they hybrids? Explain to us how that works.
Okay, basically, I mean, there's so many factors here. So short answer, no, they are not bringing back the species exactly as it is. In reality, if you want to think about it, what they're doing is they are de-extincting or, in some sense, resurrecting extinct genes. Because what they're able to do is take small parts of DNA that they've gotten from fossil material. So Colossal, they apparently got most of their genetic material from a tooth that was somewhere on the order of 13,000 years old and a skull that was 72,000 years old.
Wow.
The point is DNA that, even though it's a stable molecule, DNA that's that old is really going to be fragmented, right?
Okay.
So you're not going to have, a genome that's potentially gigabases in size present in toto and in context. It's kind of like finding, you know, the largest book you can possibly think of, right?
Uh-huh.
But only finding shreds of it. So there's that issue. So
they have to fill gaps is what you're saying.
Yes, and there are ways to do that. In other words, if you can find enough of these little gaps and put them all together, there's a thing we do called contig assembly, right, in bioinformatics. I teach my bioinformatics students how to do this, where you can take and look for overlaying or overlapping sequences and gradually build it up. But they're not quite there yet. So what's happening is they're using small bits and then using that really to get the data, right? So, and I don't know how far you want me to go with this before your next question. Interrupt me whenever you want.
No, keep going.
But so the idea is you can get this quote unquote ancient DNA in pieces that are intact enough to be read, right? Genetically coherent, if you want to think about it, right? And then you can use that to figure out, okay, that's what these sequences are, things we can operate on. Then what they actually did, and I've just read a preprint from the people who were working on this, what they do then is take those areas that they know they've got reasonable sequence data. They turn around and compare them to homologous regions in existing canids, right?
Okay.
And so by doing a lot of analysis, they can figure out, okay, like where would this go in a canid genome? That's number one. But number two, if I wanted to take that section of, let's say, a gray wolf genome, which is what they did, what would I have to change the gray wolf gene, let's say, or the gray wolf genetic material to be what the dire wolf would have been?
Got it.
Right.
Got
and
it.
So and so this is very, very piecemeal.
I mean, it almost sounds, you talk about Jurassic Park before, and we joked about it. That movie is, what, 30 years old at this point?
Mm-hmm.
It sounds almost exactly what the filmmakers were describing, and it was a Michael Crichton book before that, but filling the gaps with West African frogs and so on and so on. And it had unintended consequences, right? I mean, it sounds stranger than fiction, but we're not talking about fiction right now. This is reality. It almost sounds like it's exactly what they're doing. Is it?
In very large order, but it's even more – so obviously – The technology wasn't there when Michael Crichton wrote the book, and certainly when the film was made. However, the idea, the concept was certainly there. So conceptually, spot on. But the way they were doing it in the book / movie, it was too subject to randomness, if you think about it. Now, with the advent of being able to do the DNA sequencing, pinpoint the locations you want to modify, and very precisely make the exact modification you need at the exact location you want, it's a lot more accurate and precise than Michael Crichton ever envisioned.
So,
but still not perfect.
Right. Well, and you've got this biology behind it where you're talking about the genetic sequencing. But I mean, to me as a layperson, it seems like quite a leap to go from sequencing to a living, breathing thing. How are they accomplishing that?
So basically, several things are going on here. Number one, the technology relies very heavily on older stuff, in the sense that back in the 60s or 70s, people were able to actually clone amphibians by doing something called nuclear transfer. So basically the idea is you take, and the reason they used amphibians, to be honest, is because they are external fertilizers and they have large eggs that if you're a kid, you go to a pond and you see frog eggs or salamander eggs, right? They're easy to get. So, and they're easy to see and they're easy to manipulate.
Okay.
So go to, roll the clock back like 50, 60 years. And now you're talking, all right, well, people said, well, kind of what if? You know, they kind of knew what happened when a sperm met an egg, fertilization happens, the egg gets activated, embryonic development starts, and then next thing you know, you got tadpoles, let's say.
Right.
So what they did was they took the amphibian eggs, they removed the what they call the female pronucleus, pop it out, but the rest of the egg is still intact. Then what they did was take the nucleus from a somatic cell, a body cell, from an adult frog.
Okay.
They probably used intestinal cells, if I remember correctly, right? And they turned around and took that nucleus and transplanted it into the egg.
essentially fertilizing the egg.
Exactly. Just, yeah, that's yeah, and as if the egg could think.
Yes.
The egg reacted as if, hey, I've just been fertilized.
Right.
And now what happened is an embryonic development program began. And now, of course, what do you wind up with? You wind up with embryonic development, larval development. You've got little tadpoles. You've got little frogs, uh-huh, which are, in effect, clones of the donor of the nucleus.
Wow.
So they could do that. But, I mean, it's one thing to do it in an amphibian once you and it took a long time, right, before you could do it with, let's say, mammals. Because now you've got internal fertilization, you've got a uterus to worry about, you've got gestation, you got all that stuff. So that didn't happen until like 1996.
Is that Dolly the Sheep?
Dolly the Sheep.
Yeah.
Exactly. Dolly the Sheep. That's how she came to be. Basically, it was the same technology. It was nuclear transfer. But again, taking into account all those things. Now, so if you think about that, you can harvest eggs from a female sheep pretty easily. And if you think about it, to put it in human terms, this is almost like an in vitro fertilization kind of a thing.
Yes, yeah.
Right? So you take the eggs from the female sheep, you take the nucleus out, like I said, or the pronucleus, to be correct. You have a donor. And you get the, and in Dolly's case, it was from mammary glands from an adult female sheep. Take the nucleus out, put it in, and again, now you got the problem of what am I going to do with this?
Uh-huh.
Because it's a mammal.
Right.
Unless it implants into a uterus, forget about it. Nothing's going to happen. So then what you've got is you've got to have an adult female who's going to serve as a surrogate uterus.
Okay.
Right? It sounds like I talk about it now, and of course this is, you know, a bunch of decades later, and a whole lot of bugs worked out of the system.
Yes.
It sounds, I make it sound easy. Okay, it's not.
Yes.
Like literally, and I say this to my like biotech class all the time, you got to do thousands of these to get like a couple of them to work because there's so many things that can go wrong.
But that's where Colossal is now, right? And companies like that.
In a way, yeah, right? Yeah. But still, they've got to do what they're not saying, and they don't publish this sort of stuff, but you've got to realize there's many more failures than there are successes.
Of course,
And so what happens is, so then, in Dolly's case, then, okay, she happened to be a successful embryo implanted into the surrogate uterus, gestation happened, you know, development, it came to term, and out comes Dolly, and she's basically a clone of, you know, the donor of the nucleus, right? And then in 2001, there was a cat,
Cece.
Standard, right? Carbon copy.
Uh-huh.
Or copied cat, depending upon how you want to think about it.
Yeah.
But that cat was done the same way. What this is like, it's like a fusion of that technology coupled with the gene editing technology with CRISPR.
Got it.
So that's kind of the idea. So now where you're at is you've got basically gray wolf oocytes or eggs where the nucleus has been removed, but then you've got what you're going to put in there is going to be a genetically edited version of a gray wolf nucleus, get that in there, and then they're actually using large breed domestic dogs as surrogate uterus. And that, you know, and we can get into this if you'd like, that creates all sorts of other issues.
Yes. Is it the resurrection, though, of a prior species, or is it the creation of something entirely different? I mean, and that's the argument that I think I would make as a layperson. You're not bringing back the dire wolf.
Right.
You're creating something that has dire wolf DNA for sure, but it's something entirely different.
Right. I would, at this point, I would definitely agree with that. Yes. And so again, all kinds of issues. Now, one might argue if you do that, If you make that an iterative process,
yes,
right, where you know time passes, you get some more direwolf DNA that you can use,
yes,
and then you can do the same thing with these organisms. And so now what you can do is iteratively make it closer and closer and closer and closer to what, I mean, that is a real possibility. I'm not saying it's a super high probability, or, and I'm not saying it's going to happen overnight.
Right.
But you could imagine that by doing it that way, where the, you know, this is like an iterative function,
sure.
right? Where the output of one thing process becomes the input
yes.
for the next, and you keep building.
Yes.
Gradually, you could get to the point where that thing, that creation, if you will, has a genome that is very, very, very highly dire wolf,
wow.
right? In terms of its percentage. But again, that there are even, you know, and I don't know, I don't know if you want me to go further into some of the issues of even if you got to the point where it was 100% dire wolf.
Is it a dire wolf?
And now you get
it. So what do you say?
What do I say?
Yeah.
I say that genetically, yes, but maybe not in terms of the organism. Here's why. You cannot separate the genotype and the environment's influence on the genotype
okay.
from what the phenotype, what the organism actually becomes.
Uh-huh.
So it's almost, you know what it's kind of like?
Nature versus nurture too,
yes,
right?
Yes, and one of the things, again, that like I always talk about, because I teach an embryology class where I talk a lot about embryological development across many, many, many different kinds of organisms. And, you know, genes are fine. I mean, in some sense, you can't go beyond your genome.
Yes.
However, you can be, imagine like this table, right? You can't, if you've got the same genome, you're not going to go off this table. However, you can be anywhere on the table.
Yes.
There's huge amounts of, and still be you, whatever
yes.
you means.
Yes.
Right? And the thing about it is that's because environment affects gene expression in ways we don't even completely understand yet. We've got a lot of ideas. We know about a lot of stuff, right? So it's almost like identical twins. You know, I've got relatives that are identical twins.
Yeah, doesn't make them identical
humans. I can totally
yeah.
tell them apart.
Yeah.
They have all their own yeah. idiosyncrasies. Why? And you think about like, okay, why is that?
Yes.
Because hey, maybe one of them was over here in the uterus and one of them was over
That's
here
right.
in the uterus, and the microenvironment was slightly different.
That's right.
And gene expression during early development is supremely
so
important.
Let's stay on that environment for a moment then. I think it's one thing to talk about this as a science experiment. I think it's something completely different to talk about it in a way of introducing these animals, because that's what they are.
Right.
Into an environment and out of captivity. Is that something that should happen or will happen? Or what do you think? Obviously, that the consequences could be disastrous if with the wrong species, but are these just for zoos or what?
Yeah, I mean, that's a wonderful question. And, you know, in these moments, I literally, you know, I'm always of two minds. You know, there's the mind that's like, this is really great, like to actually do, cause we can learn a lot. And then on the other hand, oh wow, this is really is a double-edged sword, and there are some profound consequences that can come out of this. Now, again, you got to think about it. The planet is a very different place
yeah.
from the way it was when dire wolves existed. So
yeah.
now you got to think about, okay, let's imagine that we can get to a point where these really are quote unquote dire wolves for all intents and purposes. Okay. As you say, what's going to happen to them? I mean, you've got to think about what kind of habitat are they going to need?
That's right.
What is the range of these animals? Where are they going to live given the way habitat is so fragmented
right.
now due to human activities, right? I mean, that's a huge problem. That's one of the things that causes extinction in
that's
the first
right.
place.
And that's the Goldblum point, right? In Jurassic Park, he said, well, they had their chance, right? And they didn't make it, right? So is that sort of nature's way of saying, look, the dire wolf, the woolly mammoth, no, they don't have a place in this world, but obviously their descendants may, right? That is part of the natural evolution of things, that there may not be dire wolves, but there are descendants of the dire wolf, right?
Right. Well, I mean, the thing about it is the environment, and you can take that as small a scale as you would like or as large a scale as you would like. I mean, when I think of environment in that sense, I literally think about everything.
Sure. Yeah.
It is a strong selection agent.
Mm-hmm.
And if you as a species don't match with that context, you're going to be selected against and you're going to be outcompeted or, you know, whatever. So, and in that sense, you're right. And then, you know, to get kind of circle back a tiny bit, you know, what about the prey base for this organism? I mean, that's something that you got to think about. I mean, stuff that I've read recently seems to indicate that part of the reasons why the dire wolf may have gone extinct in the first place was their prey base was dropping out.
Mm-hmm.
So the normal organisms that, and to couple that with the fact that, you know what, there seems to have been really increased competition as the cats, the felids got into North America. Because they were like the canids and, you know, direwolf and its relatives and stuff like that. They were like literally, you know, no pun intended, top dog as far as predators go. But then when the cats started to come, the cats could outcompete them in terms of the way they hunted.
Interesting.
And stuff like that. And so now you started seeing the prey base was not as available as it was. Who knows what was going on with the prey base species as well. They may have been experiencing their own natural declines, whatever, plus the predation. And it was like, okay, there's nothing for me now.
So, all right, let's flip the conversation then maybe to conservation, okay? Is this technology perhaps a tool for saving species that may be on the decline? And of course, there's all the same issues that we were just talking about. Right. Polar bears, for instance, we know why the polar bears are going extinct, right?
Right.
Is there an opportunity, however, to hasten the decline of the polar bear population through a technology like this? Not just polar bears, but
you know, others. You mean to quicken it or slow it?
Slow it. Yeah, not hasten it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Perhaps. I mean, because now I think about these things at a bunch of levels. One is, you know, from a population genetic point of view, genetic diversity in populations is really important. Why? Because that gives the population, which is really just a subset of the species, right? So you can have local populations. The population needs to be resilient enough from a genetic point of view to handle a really dynamic environment, right? So the idea is, and the easiest way to think about this is in terms of like pathogens. Mm-hmm. And if you look at lots of organisms, ourselves included, I mean, in a human, one of the most still rapidly evolving parts of our genome are genes that are associated with immune responses. Because why? The pathogens, the bacteria, viruses, fungi, whoever else, can infect and or kill us, right, depending. They evolve really rapidly. Mm-hmm. So
As we all learned, exactly.
I mean, the point is that if you're an organism and you're subject to that, a population of organisms, if there's not some of you around who are going to survive that onslaught, then guess what? You're gone. Mm. So that's my big plug for genetic diversity, right? So part of the problem is, and again, it becomes this perfect storm, habitat loss plus, lack of food availability, right, causes you to have what? Smaller populations of any given organism, which means, guess what? There's inbreeding, which means, guess what? Genetic diversity is going down, which means, guess what? If something comes along, let's say a pathogen, and it doesn't have to only be a pathogen, but let's say a pathogen, if it can take one of you out, since you're all really genetically similar, there's a reasonable probability that's going to take all of you out. Mm. And that, and I mean, like I've read some horrible stuff about East African cheetahs. Mm. The populations there are like almost clonal. It's really scary. Mm. Like in the sense that there's so much inbreeding, and it's like that's a disaster waiting to happen in terms of extinction, right? Mm-hmm. So to get back to your question, the, you know, one thing I could see would be if you can go in and do gene editing, you could, in some sense, artificially increase genetic diversity. Mm. Now, again, that's not a panacea, right? It's not. But if you can imagine, you can fold in some genetic diversity and then let breeding take over, right? Let normal reproduction take over. Maybe you can give it a little bit of a buffer.
Yeah.
The other thing that they're doing, and this goes back to something that Colossal Bioscience is actually doing, red wolves are, Canis rufus is the Latin binomial. They are like critically endangered. So what Colossal's been doing is going to like museum specimens and stuff and doing all the same kind of genetic analysis. But in this case, they probably have a lot better data just because the specimens are not as old and beaten up by the environment, right? So what they're doing is they are looking at specific genetic locations in an attempt to maybe put some of the more quote-unquote ancestral red wolf genes back into existing red wolf populations, I guess with the thought of, in some sense, that might increase the quote-unquote genetic health.
Right.
Maybe, and they use that kind of term. I didn't see if they're talking about genetic diversity, which they might have that in their minds as well, right? And
or then, just the viability of the species, right?
Right. Yeah. And thus, again, slowing or preventing, putting the brakes on the problems that the red wolf. So that gets back to your polar bear question in a way.
Yeah, you can see a lot of sides here, right?
Yes.
As a scientist, right, I'm sure you can, well, you know, science is about unlocking the future and progress, right? And working on these kinds of things. But it does go back to that question of, you know, just because you can, should you? There's obviously money tied into this. There's probably, billions of dollars that could be at stake. Is that what it's about for Colossal, or were there, and companies like them, are they science people or are they, you know, venture capitalist people?
I don't think I can speak directly to that in the sense that, I mean, the fact that George Church, who is a well-known, you know, scientist, well-known geneticist and molecular biologist and molecular geneticist, I mean, the fact that he's involved leads me to believe, at least from his point of view,
right,
he's probably really interested in the, like, what can we learn from this? What can we do with this? Whatever. As far as some of the other, and I'm not talking about the scientists per se, but I think there is a lot of venture capitalism going on here, right? And because here's why. The Colossal Bioscience people, like, they want to patent these things,
I'm sure.
Which means, they want to protect themselves legally, but you gotta figure there's money involved.
Oh.
There's a lot of potential money involved.
Yes.
And so that's been a bit of a, you know, out there in the various threads that are out there regarding this, you know, a lot of people are kind of slamming Colossal and saying, oh, come on, you know, you guys are just after a profit. Let's face it. And, you know, I can't say that that's not true, given the way we are, you know, and the kind of society we are in. You almost got to expect that.
Right. So, but, right. And this sort of brings a bow to this. At the end of the day, in your view, scientific community, net positive, net negative, this work that's going on in de-extinction?
That is a tough one. I think I think at the end of the day, it'll probably be net positive because people are always going to, you know, be engaged in making profit or getting profit from such things like that. But there's also this other side of it, which things are going to come out of this that are not necessarily going to even generate profit. But I think a lot of things are going to be learned that can, whether it's just how do I do this thing, can I apply it to somewhere else? Mm-hmm. I mean, and other things, you never know where something is going to apply downstream. And this is one of my, like I get, you know, I've gotten upset in some of the things that I've been reading where there are whole groups of scientists who just slam this.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're making designer pets. This mm-hmm. is like, nothing's going to come out of this. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, and I never like that approach. I'm the kind of guy who's always, you know, throw it against the wall and see if it sticks.
Mm-hmm.
Just do it, obviously, carefully and safely, mm-hmm. yes, responsibly, right? But see what happens because you never know what the collateral right. benefits are going to – because you can't even conceive of it. It's like you don't even know what you don't know yet.
That's right. Now, again, not a scientist, right? A layperson – to me, that's the beauty of science. That's the beauty of the scientific process, that you go into this research, you go into this work, and as you said, who knows where it goes. Maybe you get your intended result. Maybe you get something incredibly different and exciting. I mean, how many antibiotics, right? Different things
sure.
have been
sure.
Through the scientific process
sure.
like that. So
sure.
my goodness, just a fascinating conversation. And guess what? We're not done. So although this is going to be our season finale of the first season of Bergen Banter, this is only part one of this Life Finds a Way topic. Part one on the science here with Professor John Smalley, we are going to close the season with a part two on this, where we're going to talk about the ethics and the moral consequences of such work with one of our terrific philosophy professors in the next episode. So this is a bit of a cliffhanger here in our two-part season finale. Professor Smalley, thank you for being here today. This has been really terrific.
Thank you. It was great. I totally enjoyed it.
Yeah,
I look forward to the second episode as well.
This is going to be fun. So never mind the noise and the chatter. We are here for intelligent, fact-based conversation here on Bergen Banter, and we will see you for part two of the conversation of our season finale next time.